Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the Internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth. The rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. And today is kicking off, at your request and my own desire, the second show of the month with Jim Fetzer. And the reason being, I never get enough of Jim. Obviously, some of you don't either. And I realize that in this society, because we have so little heroes, we have so little people to look up to, unlike when Jim and I were kids, that somebody has to speak from the older generation's point of view, the people that actually lived it. You know, my new hashtag we remember, the people that lived through real history, to tell you the trouble, danger that this country and this world is in just one lifetime. Jim and I are having a little bit of a time trying to figure out what we want to call this show. Anything from older and wiser, I kind of like 1940 to 1949 speaks, because that's how long we've both been here. If any of you out there have a title that you'd like for this show, Jim and I would certainly consider it. And Jim, just before we get started, I got this note from one of my long-term listeners, got to be with me the whole 15 years. Just want to let you know how excited I am. You and Jim are going to have a twice-a-month show. Now that he's doing video shows, his shows aren't posted with the regularity they used to be, and I miss it. So people are, you know, excited about it. And to tell you the truth, I probably am the most excited about it, because I need to talk to people that are my peers. Because when I talk with younger people, they're so lost. They can't imagine a world any different than post 9/11, Jim.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing, Maria. But for them, that was the decisive event of their lifetime. Unlike for you and for me, the assassination of JFK and everything that's gone on in between has been window dressing.
Absolutely. I mean, even just looking at this crop of losers running for president, you know, I remember when I was a young girl, that was such a big deal. It had so much honor. It had so much fanfare and respect. And now you see them all duking it out with each other like third grade ignorant morons. It's hard for me to even believe we're in the same country.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. And these political candidates just dumbfound me, Maria. They're such mediocrities, and they're such zealots, and they're so narrow-minded for the most part, which is a reason why I actually am exhilarated by the presence of Donald Trump, because he's doing so much to shatter preconceptions. He's a real iconoclast, and he's exposing the corruption of the political system as it exists today.
Well, but one of the huge problems that I see is that none of them really have any experience or any idea of what the job entails. You know, they're all coming out of left field. None of them know what they're talking about. They're all promising, you know, two or three more wars and, you know, kicking out minorities from this country. Well, the best one, you know, talk about JFK. How about when Ben Carson said that a Muslim can never be president, should never be president?
Really, that's just so shocking. I mean, did he not have, you know, a civics class in high school? I mean, we have this Article 6 of the Constitution that declares there will be no religious test for serving in the office, and that he should not know that. I think he virtually eliminated himself as a serious candidate by that single profoundly ignorant observation.
I agree. Now, I know you remember, and I certainly remember. Do you remember all the flack they gave when Kennedy was running for office because he was an Irish Catholic?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, that was a big issue. And some claimed that a Catholic would never be elected president. Here we have more recently a Mormon, Mitt Romney, running for president. And if you look into the matter, there might be more reasons to be concerned about Mormons than there are about Catholics.
Right, but Kennedy was very clear that he believed in the separation of church and state. And, you know, he made many promises that he would never make a decision based on his religion.
That's right. He was very emphatic about it, very clear. And, you know, I feel so profoundly sad over what happened there. I mean, it made such a difference to our history, and many Americans, Maria, even to this day, are unaware that of the enormity of the tragedy and the conspiracy that lay behind it, and where it was, in fact, in order to try to tarnish critics of the Warren report, that the CIA introduced the phrase conspiracy theory to imply that those who were raising questions had an obligation to elaborate and defend an account of every aspect of what had actually happened, which was shifting the burden of proof when all they were, you know, Mark Lane, Harold Weisberg, other early critics were doing was pointing out that the government's own account was not sustainable, that it was inconsistent with the evidence that the government was clearly covering up. And the deeper you got into it, the worse the situation became, where I believe today we know about 95% of what happened in relation to JFK, and it's all profoundly disturbing, Maria, because it really indicates complicity of the highest levels of the American government in removing the head of the American government by means of an undemocratic process, so that every president who has served since has known he was serving at the, you know, whim of a rifle. I mean, it's just disgusting, the perversion of our country that represented.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, and I believe that it was the first time that two candidates debated on television. Do you remember those between him and
absolutely.
Nixon?
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, those who listened on radio, Maria, as I'm sure you're aware, thought that Nixon had prevailed, but everyone who watched it on television saw this very calm, very dapper, you know, very cool John F. Kennedy and this man, this other guy, with shadows under his eyes, perspiring profusely. He even made the mistake of foregoing makeup for the sake of the television appearance. He was that naive about the media. And many believe, therefore, it was the debate that cost Nixon the election.
Well, yeah, I remember he was sitting there sweating like he was in a sauna. And I remember all the talk at that time, you know, that, you know, he just didn't do well on TV. And a lot of people said it was the first election decided on television.
Yeah.
But
I think that's largely true. And, of course, television has become the dominant media. Most Americans actually only get their news and sound bites from the major media. Although in recent times, Maria, and I'm very glad this has been happening with the evolution of the Internet, there's more and more awareness that what we're hearing from the major media is not reliable, untrustworthy, frequently simply repeating the official positions of the government, where with the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, even the Smith-Mundt Act of 1949, which precluded the use of the techniques of propaganda and of disinformation that our intelligence agencies were using abroad, from being used at home, was vitiated. And now it's perfectly legal for any of these networks, any of these agencies, any news outlet to publish whatever it wants, regardless of its distance from the truth, regardless of whether it has any evidence to substantiate it. Mm-hmm. And I think, Maria, that leaves the American public in a state of profound confusion about what's really going on, where it's in my opinion, good thing that more and more Americans are turning to the Internet and not relying upon the major media, because it's so clearly controlled and manipulative and intending to instill in us beliefs that are beneficial to the government. I mean, take this Iran deal as an illustration, Maria. I have yet to hear a single discussion in the major media or Fox or CNN or MSNBC that acknowledged that all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies had already concluded as long ago as 2007 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons. But they reaffirmed that conclusion in 2011, that even the Mossad had determined that Iran was not pursuing nukes, which it reported to the Israeli government in 2012, 3 weeks before Benjamin Netanyahu went to the United Nations and asserted precisely the opposite, even though, Maria, each of these claims can be substantiated by an internet search.
Right.
Just do a search on U.S. intel, you know, on Iran nuclear program. And the arguments that have extended to this day have traded on the trivial equivocations, such as it's not going to stop Iran's nuclear program, where Iran has long been involved in the peace development of the peaceful use of nuclear energy. So by not pointing out that their nuclear program is going to endure, but that it's a peaceful program having to do with the production of nuclear energy, not a military program having to do with the production of nuclear weapons, and the whole situation is perverted. I've never seen in my lifetime such a propaganda blitz based upon false information and deliberate distortion and the onslaught that has occurred in opposition to the Iran deal, which is a perfectly reasonable resolution. In fact, it's actually political theater because Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons, but when you have the P5 plus one reaching this agreement, it's long past time, and where the sanctions even, Maria, turn out to be violations of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which specifically state in Article 33 that no person may be punished for a crime they did not personally commit. And where these sanctions are a form of collective punishment that qualifies as a war crime. Now, every American ought to know that, Maria. That's the most basic information about the situation we're in vis-a-vis Iran. But yet you have groups that are hysterical. You have prominent politicians. You have Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee, and other lunatics on the right who are insisting that this is a travesty that is putting Israel and the United States at great risk when nothing could be further from the truth. What we're actually doing is removing abusive sanctions on the Iranian people they did not deserve and doing a modicum of restoring just policies and attitudes toward that great nation, which, Maria, incidentally, has not attacked any other nation since 1775. Our own Constitution only began its ratification in 1787. George Washington was inaugurated in 1789. So, you know,
right.
The
What's
people
the
are simply left in a state of ignorance, and it's a very serious problem.
Well, you know, when I believe it was Iran and some other countries in the Middle East asking for UN inspectors to go in and inspect Israel's nuclear facilities, that was shot down.
Right.
You know,
I know that's kind of stunning, isn't it? Because, what? I mean, if Israel actually does have a vast stockpile of nuclear weapons. In fact, just this past February, the Pentagon quietly released a study from 1987 conducted by the Defense Intelligence Agency, reporting on the state of the Israeli nuclear arsenal, which was already substantial, and that they had already developed the capacity for the hydrogen bomb. This is a non-declared nuclear state. According to our own foreign policy guidelines, Maria, we cannot provide foreign aid to any nation that has undeclared weapons of mass destruction. Israel has a vast stockpile of nuclear, biological, and chemical, and it's so well known that a resolution can be introduced proposing the inspection of the Israeli nuclear arsenal and be voted down. I mean, the hypocrisy here is simply overwhelming.
Right. So basically, our billions of dollars we give Israel is illegal.
Yes.
And yet they want more money. You know, they want more money because of this deal with Iran. You know, oh, it bothers us, but if you give us enough money, we'll be okay with it. I mean, what the hell?
I know.
Well, you
see, a way of trying to manipulate, you know, benefit for the Israelis. I mean, they're very persistent in that, Maria.
Mm, right.
And, you know, they'll try to take a lemon and turn it into lemonade. Well, if we can't get to stop this nuclear, maybe we can double our take from America by, you know, sucking us dry. I mean, the whole point of 9/11 was to engage the United States in these endless wars in the Middle East to benefit Israel. They do no benefit for the United States.
Right.
And I worry, Maria, that the younger generation simply doesn't know enough to understand when issues are purely political, the whole debate here being over Israel's desire to restrain the influence of Iran in the Middle East, especially with Iraq, which had served as a counterbalance in the past, has been destroyed.
Right.
Where, you know, Israel wants to dominate the entire region from the Tigris, Euphrates to the Nile. And people who have never studied Middle Eastern history have no comprehension. If they don't know the available information about our own intelligence agencies concluding that Iran has not been pursuing nuclear weapons, reinforced even by the Mossad, if they don't know the Geneva Conventions of 1949. Maria, I wrote to 98 of our senators about this. I got one response from one of the senators. I'm holding the letter in my hand, and it was from Rand Paul, who was reaffirming the reasons he wasn't going to support the Iran nuclear deal, each of which was a mistaken reason, and where he had a single stroke, in my opinion, so severely tarnished his brand as a non-interventionist in the tradition of his father, Ron Paul, that I completely lost faith in him. He could have stood out among all these mediocrities in the Republican Party who were going out of their way to talk about how eager they were to nuke Iran, which estimates have it would bring about a million deaths of Iranians outright, and then as a cloud of contamination swept across Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, another 35 million premature deaths. They're eager to attack Iran. They're eager to tear up the agreement, and it's just absurd. I mean, this is so ignorant. This is so inappropriate. This is so profoundly immoral, Maria. And yet I worry that the new generations here have no comprehension whatsoever of the dimensions of the charade.
Well, you know, I think that it's also a negative that a lot of these kids grew up on these video games. And most of them are just, you know, fake war on a screen, blasting this person, blasting that person. And I think that in reality, they think that it's a video game when we're invading another country and murdering their people. So you can see how they've been conditioned to be the zombies. The zombie nation is here, how they've been conditioned. Yet I have to tell you that my son-in-law, who's a very young man, the more conversations I have with this kid, I want you to know, Jim, when I say something to him, he immediately gets on his gadget and fact checks me, okay?
Oh, that's wonderful.
He fact checks me no matter what I tell him. You know, and it could just be, you know, the difference in the way life was. You know, I once told him, you know, that they actually used to test a woman's urine on a rabbit. If the rabbit died, it meant you were pregnant. I said, we didn't have pregnancy kits like you guys have today. He thought I was making this up till he fact-checked it, and then he was astounded. So these kind of stories, of course, we talk politics, too, because he's one of the rare ones that's actually open to it and intelligent. He actually said to me in our last conversation about a week ago, I can't believe how much things have changed in your one lifetime.
Yeah.
And I
think that's a profound truth,
right?
In our lifetime, we have gone from being the most respected and admired nation in the world, one that truly was a land of the free and a home of the brave, to a massive surveillance society in a state that is known now for its aggression worldwide, where we, along with our gallant ally in the Middle East, Israel, are the most despised and reviled nations today. What a transformation.
Absolutely. Even, I mean, on every level, economically, relationship-wise, the way things used to be. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that would say, because I used to say it when I was younger, you know, oh, every generation, when they get older, always puts down the next generation. But we're here, and we're still here, and look at, I mean, to me, it's just as shocking how much things have changed. But when you can spend quality time with a younger person, somebody in their 20s, somebody in their 30s, and educate them about the differences between then and now, I mean, to me, that's the most rewarding work I could possibly do.
Yes, I feel the same way. And of course, I spent virtually my whole life, my career in higher education and endeavoring to educate a new generation to, you know, better develop their background knowledge, their understanding of major issues, but especially in my case, their reasoning ability, which they could then apply to any subject or within any domain and be more efficient and effective in sorting things out, mm-hmm. which will make them inevitably more productive and significant in the course of their lives. So, I mean, I could not agree more.
Right. Now, before the world went crazy, and there's so many different dates we could put on that, before you got involved in JFK research and, you know, 9/11 research, all the stuff you and I have been doing the past 20 plus years, I mean, what were you doing? What were you teaching? Because people don't realize that you've been around a long time and you had a whole lot of other textbooks, I'll call them textbooks, on philosophy and different things that people probably are not even aware that you did, Jim.
Yes. Actually, the number of books I authored or edited that would properly qualify as textbooks might be 4 or 5. As of today, I have 30 books. Most of my publications were scholarly. I have 7 or 8 authored books, including on the theoretical nature of scientific knowledge, on artificial intelligence, its scope and limits, on computers and cognition. My history goes back to California, Maria, where I was born in Pasadena. You can see the Rose Bowl from Huntington Memorial, where I was born, a year and a day before Pearl Harbor, as my dad so often referred to it. Hmm. And my parents, like so many others in Southern California, divorced when I was young, and my brother and I lived with our mother until she remarried, and then with our stepfather moved to an area known as La Habra Heights, not far from Whittier, where Richard Nixon grew up. La Habra Heights was generally undeveloped, lots of lemon groves, orange groves, avocado groves, our house on a very remote road that was actually a dead end. It was surrounded by avocado trees. And while they were married, my first half-brother was born. So I have one full brother, a half-brother by my mother and stepfather. When I was 11, my mother died. And Phil, my full brother, and I went to live with our father and his second wife, stepmother, who had already one son. She was pregnant with her second. She would have yet a daughter and then another son. So I have brothers and sisters who are not related to one another. To wit, my half-brother by my mother and stepfather, and then 3 half-brothers and a half-sister by my father and stepmother. We moved to South Pasadena, which was a simply wonderful environment for my brother and me, mm-hmm. where I redesigned a screen porch in the back of the house. I actually made up the blueprints to convert it into a boys' room with built-in bunk beds. It was knotty pine with its own bathroom and shower and the whole bit. And really enjoyed South Pasadena, where they had gone out of their way to sort out the youth programs for the churches in the community. Very near us was a congregational church with an excellent youth program, very near. I mean, we could have walked. But halfway across town was an Episcopal church, St. James, which had a wonderful youth program too, and they liked St. James. So for the only time in my life I was involved in organized religion in South Pasadena at St. James Episcopal Church. I had been raised in a non-religious environment. My mother and stepfather had taken me one time to a Quaker service and asked me after what I felt about it. I said, it was fine. Would you want to go again? Well, no, not particularly.
Right.
But I got involved in this youth program with St. James, and I became an acolyte. I sang in the choir. I was gave a sermon on Youth Sunday. I was the president of the Young People's Fellowship. It was all rather remarkable insofar as when I graduated from high school in 1962, that summer before I entered Princeton, I was a delegate to the 14th World Convention on Christian Education held in Tokyo as a representative of the Young People's Fellowship. I had actually been the, a treasurer of the Young People's Fellowship. My brother was a treasurer, I guess, for the whole Episcopal diocese for all these...
Wow. Holy crap.
He even outdid me. It was also ironic, when I graduated from high school, I and a fellow student by the name of Karen Fanku, who was the first girl I ever took out, received jointly the school's highest award for moral leadership. She had been the candidate nominated by the Congregational Church, I by the Episcopal, and they were unable to resolve the impasse because our supporters were so firm that they awarded it jointly the first time in the school's history. And would you believe, Maria, 3 years later, when my brother graduated, he received the Carver Award himself.
Nice.
And that was the first time two members of the same family had received the same award. So it was really kind of striking in that respect. I had a very interesting trip to Tokyo. Well, my actions probably brought me to the attention of the CIA, because I went to the Communist Party headquarters in Tokyo to ask for information about communism from them, which I still have in my possession, by the way. And I think they were rather dumbfounded to have this, you know, young American come to their headquarters and ask for information. But I felt it was something that, you know, we had an obligation to do, to figure out what's going on in the world, do our own research. It would turn out years and years later, after I graduated from Princeton, where I became a student of philosophy, I went through the school catalog and I circled every course that appealed to me. And the overwhelming majority had to do with conceptual and theoretical and methodological issues. And by far, they were clustered most strongly in the Department of Philosophy. So I began taking philosophy courses, but also adjunct courses that were similarly theoretical in other departments that had a philosophical bent. And I graduated magna cum laude from Princeton and was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps in June of 1962. During my tour with the Corps, I was trained first as an infantry officer in Quantico, Virginia, and then sent to Fort Sill, Lawton, Oklahoma, to the U.S. Army Artillery and Missile School to be trained as an artillery officer. I was home in California for just 2 weeks, R&R, before I was to join up with my unit in Okinawa. When I discovered that my girlfriend from high school, whom I'd met through the Episcopal Church, was there. Ironically, her parents were trying to break her up. She was going to, with her current boyfriend, who was I don't know if it was evangelical, but they weren't happy with his religious orientation. She was up and living in Wenatchee, Washington. She'd been going I think maybe to Washington State. In any case, she was down in Southern California. We got together, and we just rekindled our relationship, and we wound up eloping to Las Vegas the day before I was to report to the Treasure Island, San Francisco, Maria.
All right. How old were you then? What were you, about 20?
21, yeah, let's see. Yeah, it was, the deal was, I was a bit impetuous at the time, but I was so smart that if I had a plan I wanted to carry out, I could make it happen. And we flew to Las Vegas, got married at Fred White's Wedding Chapel, of all things, which was a motel that had just been, and flew back to Southern California. Nobody knew. We even saw her mother that evening, and she kept saying to us, is there something you need to tell me? We didn't confide in her at that point, but later, a few weeks later, Dewey told her mother that, we had eloped and become married, and bless their hearts, they flew her out to Okinawa, where by division policy, she could spend a month for us to have a kind of ersatz honeymoon. But would you believe, just 2 weeks after she arrived, we were embarked in ships off of the coast because the DM brothers had just been assassinated, and they wanted to protect the evacuation of American civilians should it become necessary. I would wind out, anchored out in Kaohsiung Harbor aboard the landing platform Iwo Jima, where an LPH is a shallow drafted carrier that doesn't need to have the deep draft because it's for helicopters, which, of course, take off vertically and don't need the long, stable runway of a deep draft carrier for fixed-wing aircraft. When I was awakened at 3:30 in the morning by the officer of the deck who told me that the president had been shot, and then an hour later awakened me again to tell me that they'd caught the guy who'd done it, that he was a communist, I thought then that was pretty fast work, Maria, but it would be years and years and years before I'd put the whole thing together.
Right, right. And yet there I was watching that on TV, and all I could see was Lyndon Johnson, and I said, he's guilty. And I was 13, and my intuition just said, this guy's guilty of sin.
You were precocious, Maria, but there were many other Americans who felt the same thing. And, of course, when you dig into Lyndon's background, and there's a completely brilliant book by Phil Nelson entitled LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, you begin to understand it was his insatiable quest for power, his completely ruthless and amoral techniques. Mm-hmm. And he would lie and cheat or steal to whatever it took to accomplish his goals. And where he forced himself onto the ticket with JFK during the Democratic Convention in 1960, even though he was not on the long list, much less the short list of Bobby and Jack, mm-hmm. by threatening that if he were not his running mate, that he would expose that JFK had dalliances with beautiful women who were spies for East Germany, that he had Addison's disease and was not expected to live a long, healthy life, and moreover, if he were not, then he would bottle up any legislative proposals coming down from the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way out of it, but they were unable to. Jack had actually already extended the invitation to run with him, Stuart Symington, and gave him the night to think about it, but the LBJ thwarted all that. For the one and only time in his life, JFK had to rescind a political decision he'd made.
Right, he wheedled his way on in. Well, let's back up a little bit. So you're 21 years old. You've already gone through school. You enlisted like a lot of young men did, and you got married. Okay.
Well, I didn't actually enlist. When I came out of, there were two funny aspects of this, actually, because I came home one day from high school, and my mom said that I ought to apply to Princeton because I'd already been admitted. Mm-hmm. What happened was that Princeton had a representative of their alumni organization do interviews on our campus. I'd had an interview, but I hadn't thought much about it. And frankly, going to Princeton was the whole making of the man. That made all the difference in the world to me. Mm-hmm. And the other part was I was have been a candidate for a Navy ROTC Title IV fellowship, which gave you 4 years of tuition, books, and a modest stipend in return for agreeing to serve a minimum of 4 years as a commissioned officer in the Navy or the Marine Corps. I had to be admitted to Princeton. I had to be admitted to the Navy, and then I had to be admitted to Princeton in the Navy program, which had a really distinguished group in the Navy ROTC regular program in the class of 62. One fellow who would go on to become the youngest president of Stony Brook in the University of New York system and later a science advisor, I think actually to W. Another became the captain of a nuclear submarine. I mean, it was people like this who were in that particular group. It would make a fascinating book, actually, just to do a study of those of us who were in that particular Navy program. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, you know, then I was trained as an artillery officer, went to the Far East, served many training ops, the very first out of Okinawa to join my unit, which was Mortar Battery, 1st Battalion, 12th Marines, 3rd Marine Division, was to join the base camp at the foot of Mount Fuji. And, you know, the captain was showing great confidence in me by sending me out with a fire direction team to set up the coordinates for live fire drill. Mm-hmm. And we went out and he went ahead and we fired in accordance with my coordinates. And as we were lobbing, you know, mortar rounds at the base of the sacred mountain, I looked in the distance and saw the pilgrims making their trek and turned to my exec and said, "And who calls us ugly America?"
Right. Right. Well, you know, you're talking about a time that I think it's interesting because you talk about your mixed family, you know, how many kids your parents between the two of them had. You know, back in those days, even when I was a kid, if you were in a family that had less than four children, you were an anomaly. Okay. People had an average of 4 to 6 kids in those days. Do you remember that?
I think that's true, though I haven't reflected much about it. This was a nice upper middle class community, South Pasadena. We were, by coincidence, the smog capital of the universe because the smog would blow in from, you know, Los Angeles County, sprawling, all the industries, a lot of oil and so forth, and be collected by the mountains, the Sierra Nevada mountains, so that we actually had the highest smog of any city in the world at the time. Wow. Where when I was in, 8th or 9th grade, still in junior high school, I did as my science project a proposal for how to deal with the smog by drilling huge tunnels and installing fans in the Sierra Madre Mountains to blow the smog out into the Mojave Desert. No one ever picked up on that, Maria, but that was something I came up with in junior high school.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's important to talk about your life and your how you grew up and your education, because when people look at our work now, they have no idea where we're coming from. And you have a lot of people out there in so many different movements, whatever their favorite topic is, they're talking, but a lot of them don't know what they're talking about. They haven't got education. They haven't lived it. They really haven't done the research. It's almost like they repeat, you know, what they hear. But, you know, people have to get the way you grew up was sort of typical in this country. You know, here you are, you know, you were 21 years old, you got married. I remember, you know, when I was young, if you weren't married, if you were a girl and you weren't married by the time you were 21, you were considered an old maid. Okay. And you look at today where you got people waiting to 40, 50 to get their lives started, okay? But in our day, you know, for me, I don't know how it was with your parents. My parents made it very clear to all five of us, when you turn 18, you get a job, you move out. I mean, and we looked forward to moving out and having independence at 18. You know, most people were married by 20, 21. Most of my girlfriends, you know, I didn't have my first child till I was 23 years old, and they considered me past my prime, okay? I was like an old lady. Oh, my God, she's never going to have a kid. because, you know, by 23, a lot of my friends already had two children. You know, it was a totally different world. I remember 7 years later when I had my son, I was like 29 years old. And I remember while I was in labor telling my doctor, I'm too old for this shit, right? And I was 29. So you look at how it was then, and you look at today's family. And remember when we were kids, when they used to talk about the nuclear family and how it was going to destroy America? Move into a cashless society, you know, and people thought that was just fantasy. But if you look at the nucleus of the family when we were kids, and you look at today's nucleus of almost non-family, in one lifetime, it's all absolutely happened. The wild stuff we saw in the Twilight Zone seems to be happening too. And I think it's important for younger generations to know the difference, because we, you know, with all the bullshit and everything, and life was hard, I'm not saying it was 100% better, but we had so much more in front of us, an opportunity, and a beautiful planet still. And that was, you know, only, you know, what, 40, 50 years ago.
Yes. Well, the whole Princeton thing made a huge difference. I mean, I wound up doing my undergraduate thesis for the most influential philosopher of science in the world. His name is Carl G. Hempel. Ironically, later in my career, I would become the archivist of Hempel's work. I would publish a collection of his previously unpublished essays and a collection of essays about Hempel for Oxford University Press. But at the time, it was just my fortune, good fortune, to be dealing with these world-famous philosophers. In fact, when I was an undergraduate at Princeton, Maria, Princeton was ranked number one in the world in physics, math, and philosophy. So I had Gregory Vlastos, the leading expert on classical philosophy. I had a course with him, with Walter Kaufmann, the leading expert on Hegel, Nietzsche, and existentialism, and Hempel on, you know, it was just an amazing experience. So that when I was in the Marine Corps, I deliberated between whether I wanted to do with my career. And there were only two serious options. I'd taken the law boards. And my undergraduate average and so forth, and my law boards were in relation to my two closest friends. One had a higher law board and lower GPA. Another had a higher GPA but lower law boards. And one went to Yale and one went to Harvard, which were the two best schools, law schools in the country, and remain today. So I knew I had that option available. But I reasoned that if I went into the law, I'd gravitate toward criminal law, that I'd regard myself as my client's employee, that I'd feel an enormous sense of guilt if I lost their case, that I'd make a lot of money, but I wouldn't have any time to spend it. The alternative was the life of a professor, where I have a great deal of time to myself. I could choose how to allocate my time. I wouldn't make so much money, but I'd be doing something that, by and large, was socially and in terms of the national interest, more significant and beneficial by helping to educate a whole new generations of students. And would you believe, when I became a professor, I earned my PhD in the history and the philosophy of science from Indiana in 1970, where I did my dissertation for the second most famous philosophers of science in the world at the time, Wesley Salmon. And then I began teaching initially at Kentucky, subsequently at Virginia twice, at Cincinnati, at North Carolina, at Chapel Hill, New College, and the University of South Florida. It was a fascinating experience, not least of all because I was, you know, somehow too outspoken for my own good. But Kentucky, my first position, I published like 13 articles in excellent journals, a better record than they'd ever had for an assistant professor coming up for associate. I had given talks at a dozen different departments in the history of the University of Kentucky. They've never had a faculty member give talks at as many different departments, which had to do with my interdisciplinary background. And I received the very first Distinguished Teaching Award, which was presented by the student government. This was for the very first time where they had a choice between 133 assistant professors, and they gave it to me. Well, others have observed that can be the kiss of death, but I think I was just too outspoken for my own good. The chairman of the department, who had been hired in the belief he had a PhD in the philosophy of religion, but actually had a PhD in religion, so he wasn't even actually a philosopher, wanted to introduce a PhD program at Kentucky. At the time, they had a master's program, which I thought was simply excellent, and we took students who were weak in their preparation and set them up to enter other graduate programs, so I opposed it. He was unhappy with me for that reason. Another member of the department had always insisted that while he managed the logic program, that he got low course evaluations because it was so difficult. They gave it to me, and I had a group of TAs who were simply excellent and worked with them, and we had all these little students of logic who were just as happy as could be. I mean, it was just a wonderful program, got tremendous course evaluation. And there was a third fellow who got his PhD at Harvard in 1942, and who was an elder in the Presbyterian Church, and who thought it was I had divorced after 4.5 years while I was in graduate school, and we'd parted, and I was at that time in Kentucky living with my girlfriend, and he held that as a reason to oppose me for tenure. So the faculty divided 3-3. The local branch of the AAUP had been waiting for the case they thought was the best possible to bring a challenge to the Kentucky tenure system. But the senior counsel for the University of Kentucky argued against me. And would you believe I discovered he was talking with the committee after the end of the formal hearing. I mean, it was a blatant violation of my rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I discovered it had happened and I protested it. But, you know, I think it was a kind of mistake some people can make, and for complicated reasons I made in this case. I was upset with the uncertainty when they were making their decision instead of letting it ride where they should sort out their own blunder. I told them I was sure they were trying to do their best. This is to the head of the committee. Mm-hmm. And they just came in with a decision that was, 3-4-1. The best educated member of the committee supported me. He had his PhD from Cambridge, but the others, you know, I mean, it was just a matter of politics. The argument was that the department had the right to decide who would remain as a member of the department regardless of their qualifications, and that even if it were an improper decision on its merits, that they had the right to make it. I discussed this with other deans in the, you know, later in my career, and they said that could never happen, for example, at the University of California, that you could have that kind of social
right
decision.
But that was because I guess in those days they judged you because you were living in sin.
Wow.
Remember that? I bet people today don't even know what living in sin means anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, today having children out of wedlock is routine. It happens all the time.
Right.
In our day and age, that was really quite considerably, that was a scandal. I mean, that was really definitely not something that was socially acceptable.
Right, living with somebody without being married. Holy crap, that was way out there.
Yeah.
Living in sin.
Because I denied tenure, I wound up 10 years on visiting appointments. But Virginia hired me as visiting associate immediately after I'd been denied promotion. And you know, I would eventually come back to Virginia as visiting full professor when Virginia was the leading public university in the United States at the time. And I eventually wound up, instead of taking another visiting appointment, I went into a program to study computer science and artificial intelligence that had been organized for PhDs in philosophy and linguistics. And while I never completed the program because I turned out to be very bad at programming, I used it as an opportunity to explore all kinds of philosophical issues, such that my very first paper in a course about, which I wrote about, a program verification debate, whether formal methods were sufficient to determine what would happen when a computer executes a program, which I knew on general philosophical ground entailed a blunder, because no formal technique can determine what a physical causal system is going to do when it executes a program. So I wrote a paper, a 20-page paper, for my instructor, and he wrote back, you know, brilliant. He loved it. I figured, well, if this guy likes it, maybe I should submit it to a journal. And the then most prominent professional journal, and it may well be today, was called Communications of the ACM, of the Association for Computing Machinery. And I submitted it, and because there was something about social processing in the title, it was picked up by a fellow who really liked what I was doing. He asked me to make revisions. Each time I revised it, it got 7 pages longer. So it wound up being like 41 pages. When it was published, it just created this worldwide sensation. And there were letters coming in from all over the world. They, you know, I was writing responses on and on and on. I mean, it became my first, you know, serious contribution to computer science, about which I would then publish many articles. I've had, been, you know, entries and encyclopedias of computer science and technology. They've invited me to write the article about the subject and so forth. It was really quite spectacular. But the ultimate point is this. Because I was in this program studying computer science and artificial intelligence, departments look at me completely differently. And the year I was in the year before I'd entered the program, I'd been interviewed for 7 different positions, all of which were junior. The year I was in the program, 7 different positions, all of which were senior. And I would be hired as full professor with tenure by the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota that very year, 1987, where I would serve the next 19 years until my retirement in June of 2006.
Wow. So, in between all these studies and all this success, I see it all as success for you. At what point did your calling kick in as far as investigating the history we were living through and the conspiracy since? How old were you? We only have a couple of minutes, Jim, so I know it's a lot of pressure on you.
What really happened in the wake of Oliver Stone's film JFK, which was being besieged by all kinds of criticism, people who'd never even seen the film, Jan, my wife, came up and said, you won't believe this, turn on the TV, and there was a very distinguished-looking fellow standing behind the lectern for the American Medical Association denouncing all the serious students of the assassination, including a fellow named Chuck Crenshaw, who was a physician who'd published an article about it. He'd actually been in trauma room 1 when JFK was under examination, and then was 2 days later responsible for the treatment of his alleged assassin in trauma room number 2. And when I saw this man who was the editor of this prominent journal abusing his position for political purposes, I said to myself, perhaps it's time for some of us with special background and ability to become involved. And I, you know, when I saw a letter to the editor of the Journal of the AMA protesting what was going on from a fellow who had both a PhD and an MD, I felt a kindred spirit. I reached out to him and suggested we collaborate on a long article or a book. And he suggested a couple others join us, and we took off from there and wound up, you know, I would organize 5 different, or chair or co-chair 5 different conferences, publish 3 collections of expert studies on different on the assassination science 1998, murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, and the Great Zapruder hoax in 2003. And after that, you know, when the 9/11 came, it was a very natural gravitation for me to discover myself in the midst of a discussion thread with a lot of very talented people, about 24. And I just recognize all these resources that should be brought together to collaborate. And I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005. I would, you know, retire in June of 2006. But Scholars took off like a rocket. And you can still find the website, which I, 911scholars.org online, Maria. And it just went from there.
Right. Well, you just never know. Just when you think your life is over, you've retired. All of a sudden, this pops in.
More books in my retirement than most faculty publish in their entire career.
Well, I can totally see that, Jim. Well, Jim, I want to thank you for this kickoff show, because I think it's important that people know who you are, what your life was about, And when you and I speak, you know, have where, you know, like I said to you earlier, you know, my father taught us to respect our elders. And we're the voices. We're the voices of the past. And we're the, you know, there's not that many of us left that can actually talk to and warn the younger generation. And they need us. And that's the reason for this second show every month. So thanks so much, Jim. And I guess we'll continue this the next time we talk.
My great pleasure, Maria. Great idea. Glad to be here with you again.
Thanks, Jim. You take good care.
You too.
Jim Fetzer. So all you guys and gals out there, if you got a better name for this show, come on across with it. I think we should get downright personal because this world is not the world it was, as my son-in-law says. Wow, all those changes in one lifetime. He was freaked out. And I said, if you're freaked out, imagine how I feel. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this kickoff show. Of course, we'll keep getting into it. I want to know who his heroes were when he was a kid. I have so much curiosity on a personal level. And I will see you guys on Thursday when I'm back with News of Planet of the Apes. And now you know why I call it that show, because we grew up in a much easier time. So thanks for supporting the show. And if you've got ideas for the name, send it to Maria at maria.net. Thanks.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.